Welcome to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by our show sponsor, Explorer Risk Medical. Explorer offer unique CPD adventures for paramedics, nurses, and doctors. You can learn about altitude, dive, tropical, or remote medicine whilst exploring some of the most picturesque locations in the world. So if you want to take your CPD out of the classroom and on an adventure, head to their website, www.explorerriskmedical.org. Welcome back to the Shift Extension Podcast. I'm Nick, and I'm joined once again, Sonny Whitfield. How are you, mate?
Mate, I'm good. I'm super excited today because we've actually got someone on the podcast who I've been wanting to get on here for a long time, because there's a lot of paramedics out there who will talk about things they've done, but then there are those people who have actually done things, and you've really got to try and extract it from them. And so we've almost hoodwinked this guest into coming on today. We invited because I want to unpack her career and actually explore where she has gone, and so I'm not going to go any further because I want to give her some opportunity to introduce herself. But we've got on the show today Belinda Flanagan. Belinda, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Now, I'm not even sure how to introduce you, Belinda, because you've worn so many hats since I've known you. You wear so many hats. There's you know, pre-nominals, there's post-nominals. If I introduced you as Dr. Belinda Flanagan or Associate Professor Dr. Belinda Flanagan, that would be far more appropriate.
Yeah, Belinda's also fine. My official title is Associate Professor Belinda Flanagan, Head of School at the University of Tasmania.
That's outstanding. Now, Belinda, you and I have both we've worked in professional circles for, you know, the better part of a decade. But even when we haven't been around those similar circles, we see your name splashed everywhere through paramedicine these days. I don't think I've seen many conferences or many announcements that don't have you somehow involved. And so I'd really like to explore almost from the start to the beginning, Nick, if we can, because I'd actually like to know where Belinda got started, because I've been really inspired by some of the things I've seen her do. I've heard her speak about. I'd like to unpack where we even began, Belinda. So can we start off with even talking about you and where you started, when you started, dare I say?
Yeah, sure. Grew up in New South Wales in Wollongong. I don't think we want to go back that far though, but left school and started off doing nursing. Was actually one of the first RN groups to actually go to a university. Before that, it was hospital-based training. So that was a pretty interesting start, because it was a fascinating place to be, looking at that transition from vocational practice to university within nursing, which I then went and replicated 20 years later within paramedicine to some degree. So that was, I suppose there were lots of lessons learnt there. So I started off, did my nursing, did a three-year bachelor there, and then worked as a nurse for only a very short period of time before I started getting very bored of it. And at the time, there wasn't many jobs in the system that were really attractive. So thought it would be great to be an ambulance officer at the time, joined New South Wales Ambulance, and was an ambulance officer, we were calling them, in the early 90s, in Paddington, Rockdale, stations like that in Key Street in the inner city. And then a couple of years later, went to Queensland for probably a good 20 years, I would say, and worked as a paramedic in Queensland, pretty much all over Queensland, up in the Cape area for a little bit, Thursday Island for a very small amount of time, in and out of training, comms, pretty much did most jobs in ambulance, I would say. And then got an opportunity, because I was an RN, to actually do some tutoring at Sunshine Coast University in probably 2009, I think it was, and then sort of started into academia back then. I think the perception was is that because I was a nurse, I could come and teach the obstetrics and paediatrics, but little did they know, nurses generally don't do much in that space unless you're a midwife. So after realising that I couldn't bluff my way through that topic, I ended up going part-time to go back and do my midwifery, so I had some sort of credibility in the area, and sort of did part-time academia, part-time mid, and a bit of casual ambulance flooded in there as well, which has been challenging.
How was the midwifery course? We get a little bit of obstetrics training, a little bit, through paramedicine, a little bit of
exposure.
Let's even
say a little bit of a little bit.
A tiny, tiny, weeny bit.
Okay.
How was it doing that midwifery training after having that kind of context of paramedicine and nursing prior to that?
Yeah, it was being a paramedic, even for my nursing, when I'm working as a nurse, when I'm working as a midwife, it is such a fantastic foundation and probably the biggest bonus is the ability to be able to assess a patient appropriately and recognise deterioration. And there were certainly times in my mid when I was sitting in handover coming onto a shift and I was listening to a handover of a patient who quite clearly was deteriorating, yet they hadn't picked up on that, and this was before the days of the deterioration sort of scoring system. Mm. And I think just that those abilities from being a paramedic were so beneficial because I could see when someone was sick and when they were going downhill. Whereas as a midwife, your training is normally to reinforce the normal. And I think sometimes we get a bit caught up in that because birthing has become quite medicalized. And I don't think you can necessarily classify women birthing in hospital as the normal anymore. We set up women for fail sometimes by some of the interventions that we do. I could sort of see this real disconnect between, what I was being taught as a midwife as far as advocating for women and making sure that as close to normal and natural was the journey that they went on, but at the same time, that wasn't necessarily what the clinical space was like. And I think I could only recognise that effectively from my paramedic skills, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay.
What she's describing there, Nick, is almost essence of tribalism. Now, tribalism is very real even just in paramedic care amongst ambulance services. With QAS, we in New South Wales, we've got someone in front of us who's been in two different ambulance services. But Belinda has also, and I'm actually trying to develop some kind of flow chart here. But so you've been a nurse, a midwife, and a paramedic.
I do certainly know some amazing paramedics who are midwives as well, but did the direct entry mid program that don't necessarily also have nursing. I think I got introduced the other day as a triple threat. And I thought that was hilarious.
That's great.
But I don't necessarily see myself as that. And but it's interesting because we were having a conversation around, these defining of roles. And I sort of said, I didn't think about it. And I think, well, you don't ever go in to treat a patient and say, well, today I'm going to pretend to be a paramedic and I'm only going to operate as a paramedic. I use the skills from all three to actually manage whatever presentation I'm getting, regardless of whether I'm pretending to be a nurse, a paramedic, or a midwife, because the skills just obviously overlap so beautifully.
It's almost like a Venn diagram, isn't it? There's a lot of skills that overlap, but there'd also be a lot of skills that don't, which is interesting. I mean, I know that when I've worked with nurses in different remote clinics, sometimes they possess a much deeper understanding of primary healthcare than I have in the past, but they also struggle to make independent decisions because they're waiting for someone to confirm or deny them their rights to do it. But
well, I've certainly experienced the tension there, and I must admit, a lot of my mid, I didn't actually mention the fact that I was a paramedic. and it was a bit, and probably because it was actually quite fascinating to just hear the conversations of other midwives to actually get an understanding. Because I mean, I've certainly been that paramedic that's brought a woman into birth suite and copped a bit of attitude from staff, and I've certainly, as we all have, copped the same thing going into an ED department as well. And some, granted, some of those probably critical questions are probably warranted, but and maybe certainly warranted in birth suite, because I don't think we particularly manage birth that well as paramedics. But it's certainly been interesting just that just being able to, I suppose, be a fly on the wall as to what other professions, how they're speaking about paramedics, what they're, and I really did get to a point once where I couldn't help myself when a nurse unit manager was having quite a long conversation and being quite critical about the paramedics. And I waited quite calmly until she'd finished and then said, oh, by the way, you're actually incorrect. at a nurse's station, seeing people exit into any door they can was actually quite funny. But and I later didn't get a job at that hospital, funnily enough, after a great program. But it's an interesting space to be in. I think it's a shame that we don't do more authentic interprofessional learning. I think we put a label on interprofessional learning, but we don't necessarily do it well. And maybe that's how we manage it in the future, is that we actually incorporate that and embed it more effectively in our undergrad to sort of hopefully in time get rid of those sort of cultural barriers.
It's challenging because it's on the paramedic side as well. You know, we can certainly look inwards at ourselves and even think about some of the conversations we heard from our own colleagues in relation to these, because I don't think I've ever heard a paramedic speak about a midwife without referencing the, you know, the scary, the confronting, or they've had a go at me, I think.
Yeah. Well, and having been on the other side of being the midwife, receiving a patient from paramedics and being quite astounded as to, well, not astounded, because I understand that we don't receive a lot of that education, as certainly as much as what we should, but even some quite, you know, basic information that they just didn't see as important. And I sort of get it where that frustration comes from on the other side of it, because, you know, there are some times where I certainly had some of my own students bring a patient into me, into birth suite, and I felt like shaking them because I said, you know, I know you know this because I taught it to you in the undergrad as a paramedic. So don't go bringing a patient in here with, you know, a blood pressure of 160 or 90 and not think that's important, because, you know, the last 10 patients you went to had a history of hypertension and were probably in their 60s or 70s but had that blood pressure and you didn't necessarily worry about it. You know, this is not the same game here. So I can certainly understand the frustration on both sides.
Belinda, you see in ambulance services now being seen more as healthcare bodies. So rather than just employing paramedics in clinical roles, we are seeing mental health clinicians, doctors, pharmacists coming in and offering clinical care within the structure of an ambulance service. And even we're seeing paramedics go into non-traditional roles as well. Do you think this kind of cross-pollination of different groups from their traditional places, so like nurses coming out of hospitals and paramedics coming out of ambulances into like GPs and hospitals, do you think that will change some of that barriers to interdisciplinary training and work and understanding?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of feel like in the future, and this was sort of reflected into the most recent meeting we had with ARPRA and regulating bodies and representatives from health workforce planning and certainly representatives from the universities as well, it became really obvious that there was this general agreement that our undergrad for paramedicine is very much going to be a generalist type qualification for a paramedic who may not necessarily want to work in an ambulance service, but there are other opportunities that they can go into as well. And that for us in, well, particularly in developing curriculum in the undergrad space, we need to really focus on that, because no longer can we really keep putting photos up in our PowerPoint slides with ambulances in them. You know, that should never be the entire focus of how we're teaching. We should be coming at this from a position of, we are teaching a degree of paramedic science, and if a person chooses to work for the ADF or an industrial space or an ambulance service or a GP, whatever that may be, there's other opportunities for them to do that because they've got this generalist grounding in their undergrad. But then certainly where I'm hoping to see in the postgrad space, we have this advanced practice model where I can come in and I can do an advanced practice postgrad that actually, and it may be a nested sort of master's with grad cert, grad dip exit points, that might be, well, I could do a specialisation in the clinical realm and I can go up to a critical care level. I can do it into the community paramedicine space and do more around sort of primary health care, public health type units, or I can actually move into a leadership, stream or a specialisation or a education specialisation. Like being a CCP is not necessarily the pathway every paramedic wants to take. I know it was never an intention for me to ever go that way and never did, but I'm hoping that that's where we're sitting, this advanced practice model in the postgraduate space, is to actually look at those different pillars of what we do around, it might be clinical, it might be leadership, it might be education, or it might be research as well, which is a great career path. We've got students here at the moment who have, one student in particular already has a PhD and is coming back and doing an undergrad paramedic degree.
Oh, wow.
You know, what? That's a person who could be incredible going into that research avenue, for example.
Fantastic.
Wow. Speaking of research now, I mean, your career path up to this point that we've discussed is amazing, you know, like three different health professions. And then you started flirting with tutoring in a university, but then you took this on seriously. Try registering wasn't just enough, or you ended up, you completed the master's and then you went right through to a PhD.
Yeah.
And the PhD, that was focusing on a gap that you'd seen in what we were doing out on the street.
Yeah, well, I think it was a little bit about a combination, you know, between that mid and the experience I was having as a midwife and the experience I was certainly seeing in education around obstetrics for paramedics. So my PhD was around looking at the, well, two phases really. It was women birthing in paramedic care. The first phase was really to look at the quant side of that. How many are we going to? What are their maternal and neonatal outcomes? And then and that was interesting and quite challenging. But then the next phase, which probably became the most interesting, was to actually talk to women about their experience when they did birth. And we're talking about an unplanned out-of-hospital birth here. I don't think any woman intentionally plans to birth with a paramedic. But so it's that unplanned episode. Yeah, and that was fascinating. I sort of got those perspectives of women and what their experience was.
I asked the question.
Oh, look, to be honest, it was positive and negative, and the methodology I used wasn't necessarily for, you know, measuring how many of each occurred. So it was really just to understand what the woman's story was. And what was interesting was I probably went into it thinking that I was going to get a story of, well, this happened with paramedics, but using the methodology I did, which was narrative inquiry, I actually just had to leave it quite open and ask for their story. And as a midwife, it became really interesting because they started talking about this model of, well, I rang hospital, but the midwife actually said, don't come in. As soon as you come in, you're going to be on the clock, stay in the community. And I know myself as a midwife, that's exactly what we do, because we know as soon as a woman enters the hospital system, they are going to be put on a clock and interventions will be suggested to them to hurry that birth along to some degree. And that's unfortunately part of the policy of birthing in hospital. And it's quite specific. As a midwife, our job is to actually encourage a physiological birth and keep women in the community and not bring them in too early, to expose them to that intervention. So for some of these women, I think we have this perception of paramedics that, oh, these women leave it too late, or they don't actually have, they haven't had antenatal care, therefore that's why they get mixed up in having a paramedic come. But actually that's not the case. A lot of them said, well, the midwife actually told me to stay home for as long as possible. So it was really fascinating that I ended up having to actually publish, well, the woman and her interaction with the healthcare system and influence, and in some stories the paramedic was insignificant. So I was going in trying to ask questions about the paramedic, you know, experience, but in her story, oh yeah, well, they were just there so everyone felt better about it, like we knew it was going to happen. They were there as our security blanket. I knew I could have my baby. That wasn't an issue, but my husband was so stressed that they really thought they should have a paramedic there just in case something went wrong. So my whole PhD sort of got turned upside down a little bit, because it sort of started to become a little less about the paramedic. And ironically, I sort of get a bit frustrated when I see these media, you know, paramedic delivers baby in the back of, you know, someone's car. And it's like, well, no, the paramedic didn't. The mother actually birthed that baby in the back of her car and the paramedic was there to catch it. So I have a bit of a beef with that sort of, those sort of media makeup. But yeah, it really did sort of reinforce that, well, to some women, the paramedics are insignificant.
That's very, very interesting. So just to touch on a point you made about these patients being on the clock. So if they go into hospital, there's a period, like the clock starts and after a certain period of time, if the birth hasn't progressed, then they're looking at like inducing them or going for a cesarean. Is that correct?
Well, to some degree. It's, I suppose there's timelines where you would have to do a vaginal examination, see what sort of progress they've made. Sometimes you go down a path of, well, if a woman's vans have been ruptured and she hasn't started to go into labour within a certain period of time, then they'll put a drip up. Often women won't cope very well because they soon become sort of immobile, because then they'll, you know, the next thing is their pain management, and then they'll want an epidural, and we sort of head down a path of intervention with a lot of women. And it's, and sometimes the perception is, well, if we can keep them out of the system as long as possible, then the chances of those interventions actually being suggested may be less. And it's written into nursing intermidwifery guidelines specifically to actually only invite them in if there's a need for them, you know, if they're in active labour and progressing.
Yeah, right. And that first part of your PhD where you looked at like the amount of, or the makeup of the out of hospital births, how many we're going to, what are their outcomes, complication rates. Did you find any surprising data there?
Yeah, so I did this back in 2013, and what it did highlight was the issue around our guidelines more than anything, or and two things. First of all, some services have guidelines, some don't. but then guidelines largely were, I want to say plagiarised, but it's probably not the word, but they are lifted from hospital guidelines that aren't necessarily a reflection of, A, the scope of practice of paramedics, but the environment in which we work. And I remember distinctly reading one ambulance guideline that mentioned remove the bottom of the bed, which in reference is a reference to a birth suite bed. You can remove the bottom of a bed, but I can't figure out how I would do that with a stretcher. So it was quite obvious that there's this lifting of information from hospital guidelines. And that was also really strongly reflected in this idea of teaching paramedics to actually actively manage third stage in doing controlled cord traction, yet we hadn't actually, don't have the pharmacology of oxytocin. So it was this real lack of understanding of, well, from the ambulance, lack of understanding about, well, these things go together. You're only going to do controlled cord traction if you're given a drug. You're not just going to do it. So I sort of feel like, well, I wonder how much of that was, okay, well, paramedics can do that bit, so we'll borrow that bit, but they don't have that drug, so we better not talk about that, without this understanding of the physiology behind it, the problems that that creates. So I suppose the benefit was that I was working with an ambulance service who were fantastic as far as saying, hands up, there's an issue here, we need to fix it, we'll pull a team together, we'll work with you on it,
yeah, great,
to actually rewrite the guidelines, continue to review them, get them peer-reviewed. And because of that, those guidelines are looked at by other ambulance services as something that is what they, you know, I suppose a gold standard to some degree, which is something out of a PhD, as a result of a PhD, it's certainly something that I'm quite proud of, because it's an outcome that actually changed practice.
Yeah, it did. It changed how we operated in Queensland. So I think back to the obstetric guidelines, especially around the management of postpartum hemorrhage, early 2010s when Sunny and I started versus now, it's completely different, management. So well done.
Nick, I'm actually, while you guys were discussing it, I pulled up the clinical guideline manifesto and had a look at the breech delivery manners, the first one, because it's in alphabetical order, I hit B first. And I actually remember sending this to you, Belinda, and getting a I wasn't a frustrated reply, but it was a no surprise reply, because even in 2022, when these guidelines were being reviewed by Maddie Wilkinson Stokes that we spoke to last month, there's two services in Australia that don't even have CPGs for paramedics out on the street to manage breech delivery.
Really?
Which is it's a huge gap. There's two professional services without CPGs there. Wow. And when you look at breech management on this this comparison poster, the difference in the way the services who actually do have guidelines is just staggering. It's a real. I keep coming back to these guideline comparisons, and I think it's really important that we shed light on research like Belinda's, because it is literally changing the space in which we practice. And you know, hopefully, more people will start to look at it. And it's not just the state services. You know, we, Belinda, you're talking before about all of these other opportunities that are developing, and we need to start teaching into that role. But now, apart from being a paramedic, a midwife, a nurse, doing your degrees, your diplomas, your masters, and finally a PhD, you also then moved through full-time lecturing, course convening, program directing.
Yep.
And then probably the most exciting thing for me to read in the last 12 months in the paramedic development space is one of the first universities in the country actually created the first school of paramedicine. Now, for listeners who are, I guess, unfamiliar with even what this structure means, can you just give us a really quick rundown of what having a school of paramedicine actually means? Because a lot of people would confuse that with just having a paramedic degree.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, different universities will have different structures, but for us, we will have a different, it may be called a faculty, or it may be called a college. We have a series of colleges, and within those in the university, within those colleges, we have schools. Within a school, you may have a number of disciplines. So, for example, my previous university, we had nursing, midwifery and paramedicine. The university, when I came to Tasmania, we sat within a school of medicine. And I think there are some paramedic programs that sit within allied health or a health services school. It certainly varies. So basically what we've done in UTAS is remove paramedicine from medicine. The reasons why we became our own school is, first of all, the size we've become. So it was becoming a little bit unmanageable with the size of the school being so large because we were sitting in a school of medicine. And the next one was that she felt that, and I totally agree, that paramedics didn't have enough of a voice at that executive leadership table, that we were being spoken, either not spoken about at all or represented by a profession that didn't even understand us necessarily. You know, don't get me wrong, medicine was amazing to be in, and we have an amazing head of school in medicine. But effectively, the advocacy, you know, we weren't able to advocate for ourselves because we weren't sitting at the table when the important points were being discussed. The next thing was around just our scalability, I suppose. We've got an opportunity now to actually develop a school, and we've been given the freedom to actually say, well, what are you going to do with your school now? You know, what is important to paramedics in the future? Don't, and I've been specifically told, do not isolate yourself to just thinking that your school is going to be about an undergrad paramedic degree. Paramedicine is much more than that. And you've got the freedom to make that look like what you want it to be. So that's been a real challenge for me, because I'm sitting here thinking, well, I've got all these brilliant, you know, great ideas, but the profession hasn't necessarily caught up yet. Like, we certainly see ourselves in the primary healthcare space. We see these community paramedicine arms, critical care, intensive care, industrial paramedic. You know, there's so much more that we can be doing. But you are also restricted by, well, a unit or a course is not going to run if it doesn't have the numbers attached to it. There's a budgetary issue, obviously, around this. But I think probably one of the biggest issues as well was that opportunities is that it's given us the opportunity for our own paramedic academics to actually have professional development. So, like for me, if sitting in a school of nursing, midwifery, or even in a school of medicine, the jobs for senior leadership aren't often going to the paramedic academic in that school. And I've been working in this space for about 15 years now, 14, 15 years. I can tell you that there was very rarely an opportunity that a paramedic academic was offered a leadership position. So now we're our own school. We've got an associate head of research who's a paramedic and quite well accomplished statistician. We've got a fantastic researcher with an amazing track record. We've got an associate head of learning and teaching who, again, is doing some fantastic work, particularly in the primary healthcare space. They have you know, quite a different perspective as well, as far as where they want their interest to lie, is around that community space. So all of a sudden, then we've got campus leads and other various leadership roles. So it's this sort of development of leadership responsibilities and portfolios now that paramedic academics have access to, which I wouldn't say we had the experience of that sitting within another school.
Sure. Now, for our listeners, there's a lot of paramedics we talked about there that they've been around for 3, 5, 10 years, and they've worked clinically in either an ambulance service or another role, and they're looking to take that next step, move on and look for the next challenge or the next chapter in their career. And one of the things they look at is research, but they don't necessarily understand how to get into it, what it can do for them and their career. What advice would you give to those paramedics looking at research about how do I get into it and what opportunities it can create for them down the line?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a – I suppose people get turned off research because they automatically think that a high degree by research has to be attached to it, and that frightens people off. They don't necessarily want to come in and start enrolling in a research master's. It's too overwhelming. And we see that a lot. What I've sort of set up here is that and certainly our associate head research are going to ambulance services and our other stakeholders and saying, you know what, if you've got staff that are just interested in participating in research, tell them to get in touch with me. I'll put them on a project. It doesn't have to be always attached to a higher degree by research qualification. If they really just want to participate and have a small role and just have a understanding of what it's about, then that's something that's really, you know, possible to do. And certainly, I mean, you don't want extremely large teams in research projects, but it's certainly helpful if you have someone to go and do that literature search for you, those sort of things that are time consuming, that may be within their comfort zone to do that. And then be involved in actually, you know, looking at the data and getting an understanding. You know, it might just be a way for them to sort of, you know, put the toe in the water as to, well, this is sort of what research is like. And then, okay, well, I can handle this and I'm pretty confident that I could actually turn this into a master's or a PhD in the long run. We do a lot of research in universities that isn't necessarily always linked to a project, because an ambulance service may say to us, well, we've got 6 clinical questions here that we want answered, but we can't wait for 4 to 6 years or 8 years for a student to answer that question for us as part of their research project. So we certainly have our not so time critical projects going, but then we also have certainly time critical projects going that they want answers to. Because they want to change a drug, they want to introduce a new drug, whatever that may be. So there are certainly opportunities for them to engage with research, but not necessarily have to do a HDR, but we hope that, you know, they will in the future. We want growth in the academic space. You know, we certainly want growth. We don't want to be a profession sitting there saying, oh, well, we're in Australia and we've got, you know, around about 100 PhDs. And I don't know how many we have, but I don't think it's much more than that. I'd love to think that we actually can say, well, in Australia, we've got thousands of paramedics with PhDs and master's qualifications, and we're really owning the development of our profession. I would also say you don't make the assumption that because you're a paramedic, you have to do paramedic research.
Okay.
You have to research what keeps your interest. I just finished a project in Papua New Guinea where we looked at vaccine hesitancy attached to COVID, and we were introducing position I had before I came to UTAS was with Australian Doctors International, and it was the implementation of the COVID vaccine across Papua New Guinea, and we were looking at, because you know only sort of 2 to 3% of the population are vaccinated there, well, what was the reason for community hesitancy around vaccination? So you know, that's not paramedic related. It's not even midwifery related, somewhat nursing related, I suppose. But for me, it was, well, I did a master's of public health a couple of years ago. I've got that experience in that public health space. So I could really say, well, yeah, I'm really interested in that topic. So I'm going to get a research project done there. And we've got We've just got published. That project just got published. It was also sponsored by UNICEF, so we get some, you know, funding. And what was fantastic was that an academic I work with as a paramedic has really said, well, I really want to do this research, but I'm not necessarily interested in paramedic research. I'm interested in the public health space, and I could draw him into this project and say, hey, we're doing this. This might be something really cool. And an extension of this project is, well, we know that there's a lot of things that drive vaccine hesitancy in Papua New Guinea. So does that actually impact community members taking up other vaccines, childhood vaccines? Because we already know there's an increase in measles, increase in polio. All that stuff is coming back, unfortunately, in Papua New Guinea because we have this problem with vaccines. So his PhD in the future will probably look at that. And he's a paramedic researcher. So it doesn't always have to be about what we do as paramedics. Just do some research and learn the skills.
I'm sitting here adding to the list. Sorry, Nick. Sorry, Master of Public Health as well, because that just nearly made me snort on my drink. I didn't realize you had that as well, Belinda. Of course you did. But it's actually a really unique thing too. I completed a grad cert in public health, and I can't describe the things I learned about health in general. And I think it's a really relevant point you've talked about there is paramedicine is a part of health, and paramedicine does not translate to only paramedicine research. We certainly can have influence in a lot of areas. One of the questions I had, though, Belinda, was about encouragement, because I see lots of discouragement. And I mean, I think it's a human behavior to want to tell people what they can't do. But I would love to get your thoughts on when is it too early to start researching, because there seems to be a lot of stifling and discouragement around new graduates getting into research. And I think this is probably one of the more valuable times to get them in, because they've got younger minds looking at things through a different lens. They're keen. They've got time. They don't have as many distractions. And it, you know, so often things have been done that same way for so long because we've all just kind of been exposed to the system, and bringing in someone new with a fresh set of eyes can be a really useful tool. But is there too early to start research, or would you encourage people, if they're interested, to get involved in smaller projects as soon as they can?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's ever too early. We certainly encourage, we speak to our final year students and encourage them to engage with us as much as possible on research projects if they're interested. But also, I mean, in most degrees, part of the coursework is around how to actually research, whether, and I mean, there are some programs out there with embedded honours programs as well. I know Charles Sturt does a really good embedded honours program. So the challenge, though, is that workload, obviously, is quite a challenge for those students. But then most paramedic students will want to go into an ambulance service and do their grad year. And we lose them then, which is such a shame, because then it's a bit of a challenge, particularly because they've been poor university students for a period of time and financially have suffered. So, you know, they're earning money, and this, and we all need that, particularly these days. So we do lose them. So how we actually re-engage them, I would like to see maybe the employer actually providing more of those scholarship opportunities for their staff. And it doesn't just have to sit, obviously, within those clinical questions. It might be in leadership. I think most ambulance services recognise that they have real gaps in skills. You know, they sometimes put paramedics into these roles without always the qualifications to actually be there, which is a bit cultural with us, but sometimes it does happen. And then we have this expectation that they're going to perform well, or that they're going to actually get the hint and go back and do their education to qualify them to do that role in the future. It doesn't always happen. And I think an ambulance service to actually provide a scholarship program for their staff to engage more in, whether it be research or coursework, would be amazing, and I think is certainly overdue.
I would agree. Now, I'm just going to circle back. I mean, we've been through the clinical work you've done, the academic work you've done, and the work in research, as well as now leading an entire school, or the first school in the country. You've done some other pretty cool things, though. Yes. Someone once told me, and this is one of those transitions of being involved in several humanitarian projects, whether that be in the Malays or the Southeast Asia, the Pacific. But someone did tell me once that you may have been working on a project with an A-list Hollywood star. Do tell.
It's a big secret.
Didn't you sign a non-disclosure agreement?
She can't say anything, but I didn't sign it. So, she's worked with Hollywood A-listers, Nick, in some of the most remote parts of our country. And work that is way outside of ambulance services. This is work that is obviously a new area for paramedics to infiltrate. What was that like for you working outside of the norm, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. It was an amazing opportunity, but it's the various opportunities. It was doing that sort of work was certainly privileged in that you were well looked after, you were well fed.
I was going to ask about the food.
There was,
was there a fruit platter?
Millions and millions of dollars into that, and there was this overwhelming sense of responsibility as well.
Did you get the food first? Well, to the patient, sorry, to the PS care health, yes.
Yeah, definitely. But, on some of these, sets, you're that person who's responsible for everyone's health and well-being there. And it's a huge responsibility that I don't think you can ever take for granted. And you're constantly thinking, all right, well, what's my extrication point here? Where are my avenues to actually get someone out of here? Am I going to be that person on TV that ended up killing off some superstar? It's this constant worry. So I wouldn't say it was always the most enjoyable. The sense of responsibility was huge. But it's those other things that were the best experience in working in the complete remote areas of Nepal. In working in Timor, in some of those remote islands, in Papua New Guinea, in New Island province, where, we're going out by banana boat for a couple of hours to see a community that didn't even know COVID existed, let alone the fact that we were going out there trying to sell them a vaccine. We had to explain what COVID was, and here is this, amazing medication. So, it's actually having the skills to be able to make an impact in some of the countries that have the worst health outcomes is something that is such a privilege to do. And I think if anyone has the opportunity to do that, do it. Like it's certainly, I feel like you can't be selfish with your skills. You've got such opportunity to have an impact in someone's life. And when you're treating someone who is, 60, 70 years old and never, ever seen a doctor in their life, and you're there and all they really want is a couple of boxes of paracetamol and something cream to rub into their sore bones from the farming that they do, that's as simple as it can get. The restrictions that it puts on you, obviously, it's really challenging. So it's not well resourced, and that is really challenging emotionally as well, because we certainly did see some very sick children coming into camp in some of these clinics that there were very limited opportunities for referral pathways for them, and children that you knew would die. They would go home and they would die because there wasn't another avenue. But that was probably the most rewarding thing that I could ever have done.
Well,
interesting. I'm just nurse, midwife, paramedic, humanitarian healthcare assistant, Hollywood A-list looker after our university tutor, university lecturer, associate professor, head of the school.
I have a personality issue.
What a full career.
I don't
career.
Stay in one place long, maybe. Maybe that's a problem.
Whoever called you a triple threat actually did not understand the level and depth of your career, because I feel like the theme that we've been discussing and the theme that you've been sharing has just been breaking down barriers at every point, between three healthcare professions that, tribalism exists, between, healthcare and academia, between academic schools, between roles that paramedics may or may not should be doing according to people's perspective. It just seems like you've spent your whole career just breaking these barriers down to improve not just the healthcare space, but also, the opportunities for people. But I'm in awe, Nick.
It's amazing.
You have to take those opportunities to what it does do is it also gives you that international perspective. You can become quite insulated in the healthcare system of which you work, and I think you do need to have, and our students need to have, an understanding of there's a global picture here. there's not, it's not necessary. And I'm not just speaking about, you know, engaging with researchers or community members, healthcare clinics from lower income countries. There's larger projects that we're doing across the US, across the UK, that will, you know, are aimed at having a massive impact on reducing maternal mortality rates. You know, there's that sort of big projects that you can start connecting with and getting engaged with as well to have a impact more broadly. Well,
Belinda, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences and ideas and thoughts with us. We really appreciate it and looking forward to what you're going to do next in your career.
I'll build a school first and then we'll see how we go. And then I'd say I'll be up for retirement.
Celebratory trip to Nepal.
Yeah. Well, that'd be nice. Maybe Explorer might fund that for me.
Maybe.
No, Nick, thank you. Belinda, that was awesome. I thoroughly look forward to that. I didn't realize just the depth of your experiences either. I thought I got a handle on it, and I think there's actually going to be more to explore there. I think sometimes that you've got this hidden area, and that's the Masters of Public Health as well. Wowie, what an asset. But thank you, Belinda.
No problem at all. Thanks for the chat. I really enjoyed it.
If you have any questions, qualms, queries or concerns, please reach out to us. You can find us on social media, on Instagram or Facebook, or you can find our website, www.theshiftextension.org. But until next time, see you later.